Hello and welcome to the show. This is actually a different time than normal, this live show. Here we are on Wednesday, and it's during the day, 1 p.m. Eastern time. I'm doing this show to accommodate my good friend over across the pond, Philip Mantle. He's on, and after him is Dr. David Clark. That's actually on another stream. So if you're on YouTube, I'll tell you about that at the end of this stream. So Philip Mantle is on this show for about an hour or so. He's going to be discussing his new book that came out on November 1st, Introducing UFOs, A Young Person's Guide. And it's written by him and illustrated by Ronald Kinsella. And he's quite an artist. And for the second part of the show, like I said, is Dr. David Clark. Over the last few decades, this is just my opinion here, because I've noticed over the last few decades, there's been any type of public gathering, for instance, like a conference or something like that. There's been a huge drop in attendance of young people. Now, there is an exception to that, and that's Comic-Cons. They're heavily attended by young people. And but I also should clarify, this is pre-COVID days, so nothing to do with the virus I'm talking about, you know, prior to that. And, you know, most likely after that, you're going to see it's just a very low attendance of people involved. And I saw this in the antiques world. People started talking about it several years ago. So in 2009, I started a podcast called the Antique Auction Forum to kind of, you know, attract young people to get interested in the topic. I've had some success with that from some of the emails that I've gotten. But, you know, I attribute a lot of, you know, young people sort of drifting away. It's just the barrage of information and technology that is at their fingertips, and information thrown at them. And social media plays a big part in that. It just takes so much of the average young person's time. These are things that are important to them. You know, for instance, someone young is much going to rather own the latest iPhone or iPad or whatever it is, rather than a work of art or something interesting that, you know, means a lot to someone, or, you know, a rare book, for instance. But anyway, Philip is his attempt to reach the younger people and sharing the UFO topic, I think, is admirable. And that's why I'm talking to him today. It's always a pleasure talking to him anyway. But just a couple of things. If you support the show, I want to thank you very much. And I can't really thank you enough for that. You can, if you're not, for $2 or more a month. And that's at patreon.com/MartinWillisPodcastUFO. That link is also on our website. And there's a one-time a year payment just came out as a new option for those people that don't want to have that monthly fee. But anyway, I am ready to bring in our guest now. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Good evening, Martin. Nice to speak to you again.
That's right. It is evening for you over there.
Yes, it is. Nice, yeah. Nice and dark and damp and cold. Yes, it is.
Yeah, you know, it was. I'm on the coast of Maine, and I woke up this morning. It was like 27 degrees Fahrenheit here, and that is cold. So I'm not ready for it. It seems like we're robbed of the year, and I wanted summer to keep going, and it's not happening anymore.
No, it's cold and damp here, I can assure you, Martin. So maybe we should send some of this damp weather over to California and help them out.
Yeah, they could use it, that's for sure. Hey, so I want to talk to you about the book. How long had this been an idea of yours?
That's a good question, Martin. I mean, I've had the idea for a book like this, because it's aimed at a sort of high school audience, for some years now. And when we went through the first lockdown, I thought to myself, well, now's the time to get on with it. I'd done some preliminary work on it, but I thought, well, can't go anywhere. Everything's closed. It's either write this book or, you know, bury my wife under the patio in the back garden or something like that. But I thought, well, I need her to cut the grass anyway, so I better write the book instead, you know. So I'd already got the idea to sort of lay out in my head. And so, you know, it'd been around for a long while. The only thing I was looking for was an illustrator. And I knew Ronald, and I knew, you know, what his work looked like. And I just thought it would be ideal. It kind of fitted in, you know, exactly as I'd imagined. So I asked him, and thankfully Ronald Kinsella said yes. And so introducing UFOs was born, so to speak. So, it's been knocking around for a while in my head, Martin, yes.
Did you... You listen to the monologue, obviously you're trapped in the back there. Do you kind of agree with what I'm saying? You know, like there's a drop for the most part because of, I mean, that's what I attribute it to, technology and social media.
Yeah, you can blame it on whatever you like, but the facts remain that there is a shortfall of the next generation coming up behind us in this subject. And like you said, in a lot of other fields as well. And I'll give you an example. I know you've got an old friend of mine coming up after me, Dr. David Clark. Yep. I remember, you know, we're not that far different in age. I remember myself and David and others being sat at a UFO conference and people pointing at us. This is some years back, and they were saying, there's the next generation, meaning us. So here we are, you know, 30, 40 years on from that, and I'm looking behind me to see where the next generation is. I can't see them, but I decided to write this book in the hope that I might be able to assist them, if they've got an interest, just to point them in the right direction, Martin. It's not to, you know, tell them this is what UFOs are or anything like that. It is, you know, to try and grab their attention. And if they have that interest, I'm not trying to indoctrinate them in any way, shape or form. The book allows them to make up their own mind, which I hope would do if they got involved in ufology in the first place. So that's how it all came about. I mean, we've been discussing with colleagues who were sort of in a similar age group, Martin. And the things we've talked about is, what's going to happen with all our old files, you know, when the time comes, we're no longer here, because we don't have a repository for them here in the UK and you know, who's following on behind us.
Yeah.
Where's the next generation? So I'm sure they're there. But if we can just drag their attention away from their Xbox or their, like you said, their iPad or TikTok, or whatever it is, just for a moment, then hopefully we've got something that can help them along the way.
I think it's important that, and I forget a lot of times, there's a lot of new people that listen to this show. And a lot of times I will talk with a guest and I won't go into the details. And that's a problem. Because, you know, even though some of these people that have been listening since day one to my show, they don't want to hear the story again. But there's a percentage of people that are listening for the first time that never heard of certain cases. So I think this is where from what I've understood by your book, is you're giving them succinct, simple notations of what happened in the sighting, not in deep detail, because if you capture them, you capture them for a short amount of time for a span, basically.
I tried to put myself back when I was at high school. It's the kind of age when you start to get your own interests and your own hobbies, Martin. Yeah. And, you know, if somebody had put a huge, great encyclopedia in front of me, I would have just groaned. I'm not reading that. So, you know, this book in total is just over 150 pages. It's not necessarily text heavy, so there isn't lots and lots of reading to do. There is enough, and of course, I put the salient pictures and photographs and, you know, documents in there. I kind of mixed it up. And what I wanted to do with Ronald's artwork we have a unique piece of designer artwork to go with each chapter. Each chapter is laid out in decades, 40s, 50s, 60s, etc. And I just wanted a unique piece of artwork that's not meant to be exact. So the artwork is based on the first case for each chapter, just to grab their attention. And if I could grab their attention, like you said, just for a short while, that piece of artwork, hopefully, then think, oh, I like that. That's cool. Mm. It will then entice them to go a little bit further. And the book is in paperback, so you can have it the old-fashioned format, if you like, or you can download it as well. It's there in a Kindle. You can have it on your mobile phone or your iPad. I've downloaded it. I've no idea where it's gone. I have downloaded it somewhere, you know. So yeah. I stick to the paper version. I know where that one is. It's on my desk in front of me, you know. So that's, I tried to put myself back when I was getting it first interested in this subject, which was when in those high school years. And I've had a couple of people said, oh, I wish we'd had something like that when I was a teenager, Philip, because I bought books by John Keel and Jacques Vallée, and I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. I was too young. I couldn't understand what they were saying. So I'm hoping, you know, I have a copy of the book that's going to go to my high school. Not that they'll remember me, Martin. I'm not a famous figure for anything at my high school. But I thought, if nothing else, I'll make sure it gets in one high school, and that'll be the one that I went to. So that's ready to go in the mail to them. And
oh, that's great.
If nothing else, it'll be in the school library. Who knows? But so I'm hoping we can help the. And like you said, in the book, we've taken some of the well-known cases, like Roswell, like Betty and Barney Hill, like Travis Walton, but there's others that are perhaps not so well known as well, like the Knowles family from 1988 in Mundrabilla in Australia.
Right, the car that got picked up, or supposedly. Yeah.
So that's a case that's fallen off the radar. So I thought I'll put that one in, and also to emphasise, of course, Martin, that whatever the UFO phenomena is, it is a global phenomena. It doesn't know any boundaries. It's not just in the United States or here in the UK, it is all over the world. And in the center of the book, I don't know about you, but when I used to pick a book up, first thing I used to do is thumb through it for the pictures.
Yeah, so I used to always read the last page.
Well, I used to read the cover, the back cover, see what it said on there. And, but I like to, so I, you know, I'm biased. I like to have illustrations and pictures in. So what I did, I contacted a number of colleagues in different parts of the world. So, look, I'm putting this book together. Which UFO photographs do you think I should include in it that are supposedly authentic? So we've got well-known ones like the Paul Trent at McMinnville and others. But there's some in there you probably will have never seen before. But the introduction to that section, it's called UFO Photophile, starts with a hoax. You know, it's a hubcap, I think, from Project Blue Book. And the last word on the introduction says, make up your own mind, you know. So, again, even though we're showing them photographs that are claimed to be the genuine article, we're saying you make up your own mind. You come to your own conclusions. And there's another section in there, Martin, that says a few little tips to do if you make a UFO sighting. You know, you've got a camera, well, use it. You know, if there's somebody else standing nearby, draw their attention to it. Make sure you check the time and the date and the location so you've got all that information. Little things like that. And then, of course, to round it all off, I haven't said UFOs are X, Y, or Z. What I've said is here are three theories. There are more, but here are three for you to consider. Extraterrestrial, some kind of secret military vehicles, or some kind of rare natural phenomena. Again, there are more theories than that, but you go away and make up your own mind.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the way the whole book flows. And hopefully
that's great.
We've got something right. I keep my fingers crossed.
You know, I had the UFO sighting that I had, you know, it wasn't spectacular, but it was still a UFO sighting. But that was back in 2006. And I had no idea when I saw this thing what I was supposed to do. And the funny thing is, it never occurred to me to look online. I never thought there was, never knew anything about a MUFON or whatever. So I called a police department. Yep. I mean, so you do you kind of have that laid out too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Report it. You know, report it, because there may be others that have seen exactly the same thing and have also reported it. And whilst our Ministry of Defence no longer deals with it, our police are duty bound to deal with it. It may not be the list of their priorities, so you might not get a police car with its blue light flashing, but they are duty bound to take it seriously. And but yes, to report it. That's why it's important to take the correct time. You know, just check your watch or your phone, what time it was.
Yeah.
Location you were in, and that enables you, if need be, for an investor to go back and stand in the exact same spot you were. And there may be a logical explanation for it that you hadn't perhaps thought about before. So, because we know most UFO sightings do have an explanation. Yeah. So the more information, I mean, I've spoke to so many people, Martin, they said, oh, I had a camera with me, but I never thought to use it.
Yeah, you know, I understand that. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, use it. And you know.
You're just baffled by the incident when it happens, though. I mean, I didn't have I don't think I had my phone on me at the time, but I never thought of anything but just staring at this thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Well, that's it. That's it. And if, you know, like if you stood at a bus stop and there's somebody else there and they're looking in the opposite direction and say, excuse me, you know, what do you make of that? And don't be afraid. And, you know, if they ignore you, well, then fair enough. I know we're living in different days today, but this was written with a, you know, without the COVID in it. So hopefully it will help. I'm not saying it's got everything in there, but it will hopefully, you know, assist the next generation that's coming along behind us. I'm sure they're there somewhere, Martin. It's just dragging, like you said, dragging them away from their technology.
Yeah. Another thing I think is important, I don't know if you list this in the book or not, but I think it's personally, I think it's very important for someone to immediately write everything down. You know, I mean, I don't know if you had that in your book or not, but I think personally, drawings, writing everything down, like you said, the time, location, what it looked like, where directions, if you can, you know, where it was coming from or going or whatever.
Well, one of the good things about the technology today, and I'm sure I've got it on my smartphone, although I would not be able to find it anywhere, you can actually just pick it up and record a message into it.
That's true. Yeah.
You don't have to write it down anymore. You said, I'm standing here, I'm looking at X, you know, 3:15 in the afternoon, and I've just seen this. And you've got it there for all time. You can share that then with others. You know, the technology is fantastic to be able to assist in this fashion now. So
true.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have my kit. I used to have a bag with a camera in it, binoculars, a compass, and, which was always more important to me most of the time, a tape recorder, you know, the old cassette recorder, and a notebook and pen, and a spare pen as well, you know, because I use them more than anything, really. But today they've got digital technology, I think, taking place of that. But you're right, document it in whatever way you can.
Yeah. It's funny, this is really nothing to do with UFOs, but it's kind of a point. I was down at the Boston Commons during the summer, and I look up and there's one of the blimps flying over, and I thought it was really cool. So, I'm going to film this. By the time I got my camera, you know how slow a blimp goes, you know, very, very slow. By the time I got my camera out in my phone, did the password, got the video up and started filming, I just caught the tail end of it going into the trees were hiding it. I mean, it really, that's the problem a lot of times with UFOs when it comes to picture taking.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, that wasn't even a UFO, but I mean, just the fact that, you know, by the time you get all ready, you know, you say you have your camera, your recorder and everything, but a lot of times by the time you get it out, it's just whatever it is already gone. you know.
That may be our generation, Martin. I've seen my daughter with the thumbs, and they're like, you know, they're almost on fire. And I'm amazed that you mentioned a password. I wouldn't know how to put a password on mine. So, you know, I don't know. I've never taken a selfie. I tried it once, and it didn't work. So, you know, I'll just stick with the normal stuff. I was brought up on the old 35 millimeter camera.
Oh, yeah.
With real film in it, you know.
Same here, yeah.
But I've seen my two daughters, they're like, you know, just they can use them as if it's just part of them. And even my youngest granddaughter, sorry, my oldest granddaughter, she's 10, and she looks at me as if I'm from the Stone Age when I talk about these things, you know.
has your family, even your grandchildren and all that, do they think it's interesting that you have explored this topic for so long?
Yes, certainly my two daughters, not the grandchildren, they're a bit young for it. Although
I see,
I did make a TV series this year.
Oh yeah,
it's on Amazon, so I'll give it a plug. It's called Alien Autopsy: The Search for Answers.
Yeah,
so it's a 4-part series all about the Alien Autopsy film, and of course, my daughter put it on the TV, and there's the three of the five grandchildren sat there thinking, what's granddad doing on the television? You know, they couldn't really understand it.
Yeah.
And they were kind of looking at it and thinking, is this real? You know, but yeah, granddad was on the television. So they just thought that was amazing, you know? Yeah. And, but my two children, I have a stepson as well, but my two girls have grown up with it, of course, you know, it's always been part of their life. They're not interested in the subject, but they've always shown an interest in what I've been doing and what's next on, you know, what's dad doing now? Oh, that looks great. My youngest girl, Shona, she's got a lot of my books, you know, and so she's got them on the bookshelf. I'm not saying she's ever read them, Martin, but she's got them. You know.
I hope you sign them for her.
of course, yes.
Yeah, you know, my son's the same way. My son is a real deep thinker and thinks, you know, there can be something to this, but he thinks there really is something possibly to the Ariel school incident for one.
Yeah.
But other than that, he's, you know, I would say a healthy skeptic for the most part, thinking there's usually an answer, and there is usually an answer for whatever it is. But like I'm sure you've heard a million times, it only takes one, you know, real incident to change everything we know.
Well, really. Yes.
I mean, if it could only be proven.
Well, we were talking about it before we came on. So if you like, we'll talk about Pascagoula.
Sure. Yeah.
For those that don't know, a few years back, when I began my little publishing company called Flying Disc Press, I obtained the rights to republish Charles Hickson and William Mender's book that came out in 1983 called UFO Contact at Pascagoula. It was a case that had always been fascinated in, but it was one of those cases that disappeared off the radar. So in the process of publishing or republishing that book, I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I could find Calvin Parker and get an interview with him? I knew Charles Hickson had passed away. I didn't know anything about William Mendes, but I thought, I think Calvin may still be around. So I set off on a hunt to try and track him down. I went to the you would think, the right places to begin with, which was the UFO groups that are around in America. Not going to mention any names, but one of them had a branch in Mississippi, because that's where Pascagoula is. I thought, I'll ask them. Not only did they not know where Calvin Parker was, Martin, they had never heard of the Pascagoula case.
Wow.
Never heard of it. And I was dumbstruck. So I put out a request, and there was a certain gentleman by the name of Martin Willis, that was responsible for putting me in touch with Calvin Parker.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Yeah, well, when I spoke to Calvin first, very polite, but didn't say an awful lot. And unbeknown to me, what had happened prior to me contacting him was him and his wife had been to a funeral, a friend's funeral, And I don't know if it was a book of condolence or whatever, Martin, but he signed something in the church, and he signed it Calvin Parker. And of course, those coming behind him are sort of going, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, the guy who was abducted. So Calvin thought this was a bit disrespectful, you know, because they were at a funeral. Anyway, his wife, Waynette, said, well, why don't you write a book? And then everybody will know your story. Because he'd never told it in full anywhere, really. So he said, yeah, okay. He just tried to placate his wife. And then, of course, I appeared on the scene, not wanting a book, just an interview. And it was at that point, he said, I'm thinking of writing a book. So I said, well, I may be able to help. And he'd made some notes, which he sent me. And I said, well, do you want to do it? And, you know, with me and Waynette, he didn't really have a choice in the end. But kind of long story short, Calvin wrote Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter, My Story. It came out in 2018 and it went on to be an Amazon bestseller, which was great. But what did happen, Martin, as a result, is that other people started to come forward.
Yeah.
And they said, well, I saw something that night. And I'll give you an example. And
Philip, can I just interrupt you for a second? Because we're going back to the point where, can we just do a nutshell of the incident just because, I mentioned, there's a lot of new people listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the 11th of October, 1973, Charles Hickson, who was 42, Calvin Parker, who was 18, almost 19. Calvin had moved out there to get a job in the shipyard, working with his father's friend, Charles Hickson. He was engaged to be married, was Calvin, and he wanted a steady job. So this is 200 miles from home. It was his first day on the job, working in the shipyard as a welder. But one thing the two men did share was their love of fishing. And, of course, they were right by the Pascagoula River. So Charlie says, do you want to go fishing tonight? Yeah, great. Grab some gear, you know, drive out and buy some bait. And they're driving to an old pier because Charlie knew the area. And as they're driving in, they pass a car that's parked up already. It's got a courting couple in it and a no entry sign. And Calvin's not happy with that. But Charlie says, don't worry about it. You know, I come here all the time. So they tried one spot and they just got, you know, invaded by insects. So they moved to an old abandoned pier and sat on that. So you've just got the water in front of you and all this stuff behind you and the fishing away. And, you know, Calvin's in fishing mode. He's just thinking of the fish and he sees a boat. And then there's a blue light behind them. Calvin thinks, I knew we shouldn't have ignored that no entry sign. It's the police. We're going to spend the night in jail. Of course, when both men turned around, it wasn't the police. There was a large rugby ball-shaped object descending. Calvin's first thought was to run back to his car because I think he had a handgun in it. But he couldn't get past this thing, and there was only the water behind them. It was giving off this really intense hazy blue light, which hurt their eyes. It stopped just a couple of feet above the ground. There was two lights on one end. An opening appeared, as if from nowhere. Three humanoid creatures, again, floated out. They didn't touch the floor. They literally floated across the ground towards them. Calvin described them, it's even now he calls them the big uglies. They were humanoid, but they had no neck. They had carrot-like protrusions sticking out the side and one out the front. Their hands were like mittens or claws. Their legs remained together all the time, and they were wrinkled. They were grey-coloured, but they were wrinkled like elephant skin. Two grabbed hold of Charlie, one got hold of Calvin. Calvin was petrified. He was terrorised. And then he said he felt some kind of prick in his arm, and that relaxed him. Cutting a long story short, they were both taken on board this thing. So they were separated. Calvin said this thing descended from the roof and went around him as if it was taking pictures or x-rays or whatever. And then they got hold of him again, felt another prick in his arm, so it calmed him down, and they were deposited back on the pier. And this thing was off, gone. And they debated for quite some time what to do. And Calvin didn't want to tell anybody. He said, they'll think we're nuts. Yeah, that's what they look like. And he was terrified. And I mean, I use that word correctly. So they jump in his car, they take off, and then they have a change of heart, or rather Charlie does, and persuades Calvin to pull in at a phone box, you know, a public call box. He phones the nearby Keesler Air Force Base, and they say, we don't investigate UFOs anymore. Ring the police. So they ring the police, and it's actually the sheriff who says, stay there, and we'll send a car out. And so a car came out and drove them into town, escorted them, if you like. They were interviewed separately. They told the story. However, Calvin at that point had agreed with Charlie that Charlie would tell the story, and they would claim that Calvin had passed out, so he couldn't remember anything.
Right, yeah.
So they were interviewed by the police, by the sheriff. They were then put in a room together, and there was a desk next to them, and they were left alone. And unbeknown to them, there was a tape recorder playing in the desk, recording what they were saying. And after about 10 minutes, the police come and took this tape. Again, they weren't aware of what they'd taken out of it. They played it back, and, of course, they thought, we'll catch them now. But they weren't. They were still terrified. This is known as the secret tape. Calvin's praying almost at one point, saying, I've got to get something for my nerves. What we're going to do? So it was at that point the sheriff began to believe them, you know. Mm-hmm. And they went home. They decided to go to work the next day and try and put it all behind them. Somehow the story got out and it hit the headlines. They were bombarded by the media. Cutting a long story short, Charlie did take the front. You know, he spoke to the journalists. He went on television, went to the UFO conferences. Calvin went the opposite way. He went back home. A few weeks later, he ended up in hospital with a breakdown. He got married and he tried to keep away from the subject. He occasionally popped up. But he tried to, you know, not have any involvement. And it was only when I teamed up with him in 2018 that he decided that now's the time to tell everything. Yeah. Because not only that, 20 years later, he had another encounter while he was fishing on his own. And him and a friend of his tracked down the late Bud Hopkins and put Calvin under regressive hypnosis. And so, you know, we had that information at hand. I also uncovered that Charles Hickson had also been hypnotized by Bud Hopkins twice.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, in two different years. So we managed to find those tapes as well. And so Calvin did, this is a really interesting story. Calvin did a little local television piece. And somebody put it up on YouTube, Martin. Yeah. And there was a comment underneath it, amongst many, and I read it, and it said, my mum and dad were on the opposite side of the river that night, and they too saw the UFO.
Yeah.
That kind of grabbed my attention. You know, so there's a name. So I contacted this person. She says, yeah, my mum and dad were more than willing to speak to you. I've asked them. And they were Mr. and Mrs. Blair. And I spoke to them. And what they told us was they were indeed on the other side of the river at that point. It's a big river. Mr. Blair worked in the fishing industry and was waiting for a boat to come in. And it was late. So he'd had a nap in the back of his car and he wasn't in the best of moods. And they saw the blue light over the opposite bank of the river. Mrs. Blair said, it looked like it was lost or as if it was looking for something. It was kind of, and Mr. Blair saw it, and then his boat came in. But by this time, it's dark, so they're walking along this little pier, and Mrs. Blair said there was this huge splash in the water next to us. And she says, when I look down, there's a grey man in the water.
Hmm.
A grey, that's what she called it. That's not my word. She called it a grey man.
Wow.
In the water, she said it went under the water and was gone. She ran up to the boat, threw her husband's belongings on the boat, and turned around and ran because she had to go back to the car. He was going out fishing, she had to go back the way. So, and then, of course, the next day she sees Charlie and Calvin's story on the TV. But Mr. Blair said, we're not going to tell anybody. We're not going to say anything. At that point, he'd only admitted to seeing the blue lights. So, you know, we spoke to him, we interviewed them. Some time passed, and unfortunately, Mr. Blair took ill. And he spoke to me and he said, Philip, I'm going to tell you for the first time, and I've just told my wife, I too saw the humanoid that night. That was, again, his word was humanoid. Excuse me. He says, I saw it come up out of the water, go back across the river, and I saw the UFO take off. Hmm. And sadly, a few months later, Mr. Blair passed away. But he wanted to tell us that. I think he had it in the back of his mind, Martin, that his days might be sadly numbered. And Mrs. Blair had always had, she said to me right from the beginning, she said, Philip, I've often wondered if something similar didn't happen to me and my husband that night, that happened to Charlie and Calvin. And, we have, and there's more, that's just one, Martin. You know, it's fascinating. Again, another gentleman that night on the other side of the river is a chap called Lewis Lee. Mr. Lee was working in the shipyard as a crane driver. And he said, my cab in my crane was about 10 or 12 feet off the ground. And he said, as soon as I got in it, he said, I could see this thing out across the river, this blue diamond, he called it. Mm. I can't do a Mississippi accent, I'm sorry. But he said, it's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. Then he watched it for about 10 minutes. And the only reason he took his eyes off it is because he had a load on his crane and his friend is shouting, watch what you're doing, you know?
Yeah.
So he dealt with his load on his crane and looked back and it was now gone. So, those are just two out of, I would say, a couple of dozen witnesses we've got from around that area, either just before it happened or just after.
Yeah.
So, we've got sightings from all around there. And what is interesting, I asked Calvin if he got any documents or photographs or anything. He said everything he had was lost in Hurricane Katrina.
Mm.
His house was under 10, 12 feet of water.
Mm.
So I contacted all the UFO groups, and the Center for UFO Studies sent me a PDF file. It was all they had on the case. Most of it was newspaper cuttings. However, right in the middle of it is a one-page typewritten document. And the reason I know it's typewritten and not written on a word processor is because they've typed the date wrong and they've just gone back over it and retyped it. So it was dated the 13th of October, 1973. And it's headlined, Puncture Wounds.
It describes
a physical examination of both Charlie and Calvin. The only thing they didn't examine was their private parts, and that they found puncture wounds on both men. Now, bearing in mind, Calvin said he felt some kind of pinprick, which calmed him down. And we don't know who wrote that document. There's no name on it. But we have an idea what we think it was. But it's fascinating nonetheless, Martin. And I'll give you another example. A couple of weeks after the event, just a bit further out in the same river, there are two little boats fishing. They're all friends. And believe it or not, they saw something under the water. They said it looked like a parachute shaped, about 30 feet in diameter. It was illuminated white, although it had a brownish tint to it, but that was just the water making it brownish. And not only that, they got so close to it, Martin, they hit it with one of their paddles off the boat, and it went clunk. So they went and reported it in person to the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard sent a boat out, and the Coast Guard saw it as well, and the Coast Guard also hit it. So we managed to obtain all the Coast Guard documents about this. And then in a file, I was also sent a photograph of all the witnesses, all those fishermen. It's a colour photograph. They're all lined up. And on the back of the photograph is their names and their age. And so we recently put that photograph on social media. Yeah, that's the Puncture Wounds document.
Yeah, I really can't make it any larger than that, unfortunately. Yeah. But yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah,
it's all right. So we put this photograph of these people who were fishing that night. And within a couple of hours, with people saying, we know these people, they're deceased, they're deceased, they're deceased. Oh, but I think he's still alive. So there's about seven or eight of them. And within no time, I had a lady contact me and say, yeah, I'm related to that person. He's still alive. Mm. And again, the same day, we had his telephone number passed to us and he was willing to speak to us. And we have a colleague of mine by the name of Dr. Irina Scott.
Oh, yeah.
In the States. Irina spoke to him and interviewed him, took a full statement from him. And he was one of those fishermen that night with this thing with one of the paddles off the boat, and it went clunk. And he says the next day, you know, the Navy were involved. And he says, I took them out to where the incident was, but he couldn't see anything. It was just water. So things happened afterwards as well, Martin, which is I find fascinating. And it's we got an amazing statement from him. We really did. You know, where they were, this location is not out in the middle of nowhere. That's what we should emphasize. So we thought we might find other witnesses because of where it happened. This is not Roswell out in the desert. You know, this is right next to, people still go fishing at the same spot. It's just that the pier's not there anymore. And over the river, it goes Highway 90, huge great road bridge. So some people criticize the case. Well, saying, why didn't some of the drivers on the bridge see it? Well, they did, because we spoke to one. Irina interviewed him, and he was in the car with his wife driving across the bridge, and he said to it, he said, I thought it was an aircraft of some description that was going to crash. There was this blue light down below us, right where Charlie and Kelvin were. And he said, I watched it for about 30 seconds. My wife didn't see it because she was sat on the other side of the car. She couldn't see it from where she was sitting. But what was interesting, this gentleman said, the next day, I drove, I think it was his aunt's, he said, I drove down to my aunt's, who lived down by the river. I didn't see anything. And before I had a chance to speak to her, she says, you'll never know, you'll never guess what I saw last night. She'd seen the same thing. Yeah. Those are just a few of the many examples we've got. So a lot of these were in Calvin's follow-up book, which is called Pascagoula, The Story Continues. But that you know, but we've interviewed more since that book was published. And it's all down to you, Martin, because it was you that put me in touch with Calvin Parker. And I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad it worked out the way it did. And it's I'll just tell a little backstory to that is I had a blogger at the time, Michael Lauk was his name. And he wrote a story about the Pascagoula incident, and he was always very thorough and did nice work. So I got this email one day and it said, that's a very accurate and nicely written blog about that incident. And then I saw him sign it, Calvin Parker. So I wrote him back. I said, well, wait a minute. And you know, his email says fishing, you know, he still loves to fish. So I wrote him back and I said, so is this the Calvin Parker? If so, would you be up for an interview? And so I had interviewed him. He hadn't been interviewed for years and years and years. And I felt really honored to interview him. He's such a gentleman. And he's a lot of people think because he's Southern, has a Southern accent, you know, maybe he's not. I'm not saying this, but I've had people just assume that maybe he's not all that bright or whatever. The guy is sharp. Absolutely. And he's had a major construction company. He's done all kinds of amazing things. He's a real sharp guy. And what a gentleman. He's just such a nice man.
Absolutely. I mean, Calvin and I and his wife, Wynette, we've become friends. And like you say, he didn't have any great formal education. Calvin will admittedly say he was the brawns and his brother was the brains. If anybody picked on his brother, they had Calvin to deal with. But he was nonetheless not stupid. He just didn't like school. And so he was he's a self-educated man. He can do calculus. He is a clever guy, but just not doesn't have a formal education. So there is a difference. Yeah. And sadly, his brother is no longer with us. Calvin's led a fascinating life in some respects. And what I can say is that just by chance we were contacted by a TV and film producer in California, and it's no secret he's done a contract with Calvin, not with me, it's with Calvin, and has written a screenplay. It's finished. But I've been allowed to read it, and it is very, very accurate, I can assure you, Martin, and it is a fascinating story. And he's just sort of tweaking it a little bit at the moment. So hopefully at some point, you know, we may see it either on the big screen or the small screen. And Calvin, the most important point is that Calvin likes it.
Yeah.
He's giving it the green light.
Yeah, that's good, because he's told me before when I asked him that question, he said that he will bow out of anything, you know, if someone tries to sensationalize.
Yeah,
He's not interested in that. No, and he's not interested in money either. That's not anything that motivates Calvin. No,
when we wrote the book, Calvin said, I thought we'd sell about 10 copies. but of course, the first one went on to be an Amazon bestseller, and the second one did okay as well. There's nothing wrong with that, but certainly wasn't anything we expected to happen.
Yeah,
we just wanted to tell his story, and that's how we remain. And I was thinking about putting that story and introducing UFOs, but I got so close to it and I got so much information, I thought I can't really do it justice in just 3 or 4 pages.
Sure.
So I purposely, you know, left it out.
Yeah, that one is so complicated because of the beings and the floating and, you know, the examination and, oh, God, that is just such a complicated case. But, you know, we are right near the end of our time. I do want to say this. A lot of times people have contacted me. I talked to you about this off air, and they'll say, you know, why do you talk about the old cases? Well, here's a really good example.
Yeah.
Why, when you talk about the old cases, all of a sudden you find new information, new witnesses that are finally at this time in their life feeling comfortable about coming out about it. So I think it's a great service you've done. I've tried to put other people in your hands because of this wonderful job you've done with Calvin. And I don't know if any has worked out, but at least you did a wonderful job with Calvin. And
I'm convinced that if we had all these witnesses take their testimony to court, Martin, we could prove that something happened that night. I'm not saying we prove it was abducted by aliens, but we could prove our case. That's why it's important to keep an eye on these old cases.
That's right. That's right. Philip, as usual, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure, Martin. And please give my regards to Dr. Clark. We're old friends.
I will. And, I'll tell him what you said, too.
Yes, please do. He'll smile. He'll laugh.
Yeah. All right. You take care. All right.
Good night. God bless, Martin.
All right. Bye now. Right, and welcome. My guest now is Dr. David Clark. I've actually seen him on various UFO-related TV programs for many years, and I do believe this will be an interesting show. I encourage everyone to read his very extensive bio. It's really quite amazing all he's been involved in. Just briefly, I will tell you he's an associate professor in the Department of Media, Arts and Communication School of Social Sciences at Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. His research interests include investigative journalism, the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, official secrets, censorship, and media law. Since the late 1990s, much of David's research has been concentrated on British government policy toward UFOs, UAPs, and other unexplained phenomena. And again, I suggest that you check out, we're going to be actually talking about some files too, that historical files, which I think is fascinating. But without further ado, I will bring David in. Welcome to the show, David.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to start out by asking you, because you're kind of what I consider a healthy skeptic on the topic. But it's also your study. So what gets you interested? Oh, and by the way, for those of you on YouTube, check out the poster behind him, 1956 UFO movie. Yeah, that's a great poster.
It's the original frame poster.
I'd like to buy that from you. We'll work out a deal. No, just kidding. But can you tell the audience how you began your interest in the topic of UFOs?
Well, many people in childhood, I think it began. You know, I watched all the TV programs that everyone else watched, and I think it was going to see Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the Spielberg movie at my local cinema, which must have been 1978. But I was interested in the subject before that, and not just UFOs, you know, the whole sort of ancient astronauts thing. I bought all the paperbacks that you could buy back then, you know, Chariots of the Gods, the Bermuda Triangle, all those sorts of things. And it just blew my mind. And it was all I consumed at the time, along with comic books and Spider-Man and, you know, the usual things. But you see, I put all that aside. That was like childhood. And yeah. Off I went, got involved, became a journalist, did a degree in archaeology. That was the direction I went in. And I ended up back in working as a journalist and doing investigative journalism. And this was during the period when the subject, you know, sort of had its revival, you know, around the, what was it, the 40th, 50th anniversary, I forget now, of Roswell and mid-1990s, you know, and then there was the interest in the X-Files. And at that time, we had these horrendous secrecy rules in the UK, where we had to wait decades and decades to see government documents. And then Tony Blair, who became Prime Minister in 1997, he was the first Prime Minister who said, right, you know, we've had secrecy for too long and we need to have a Freedom of Information Act. So he brought in a Freedom of Information Act whilst I was working as a newspaper journalist. And I remember at the time very distinctly my editor saying, this is a really big deal. You know, we need to, as journalists, get behind this, and all of you need to go and you need to find a subject, you know, that you can use the FOI to sort of discover more about it. You know, and immediately I just thought, well, UFOs has got to be the thing that I need to follow up, because as a teenager, when I was doing my UFO investigations as a sort of an 18, 19 year old, I remembered writing to the person who was the head of the supposedly the head of the UFO desk at the Ministry of Defence. This was a chap called Clive Neville, and I got into quite a conversation with him. This is, I don't know, mid-1980s, and I just thought, what a weird thing that this person is sort of writing to me, a teenager at the time, about this subject. So I knew that they had lots and lots of files on the subject. And I knew that, like, for example, the Rendlesham Forest incident was a huge cause célèbre of the subject, you know, the British equivalent of Roswell. And so when we got Freedom of Information, I just thought, well, isn't it about time that someone actually tried to find out how much material they are actually holding and what it amounts to? So that's really how I sort of got involved in the late 1990s, and it all sort of spiraled from there.
Now, when you talk about the FOIA, when it first became enacted, was it pretty cut and dry how you could apply for documents, or was it, did you have to jump through hoops to get it
in the beginning? Well, it's, I've tried to simplify it there, because what we actually had was, we had a Freedom of Information Act even before the official one arrived, because from around 1994, the Prime Minister before Tony Blair, which was John Major, he was the Prime Minister between Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, he sort of introduced like a halfway house for freedom of information, whereby journalists and historians, if they were interested in a certain topic, could write to a central government department and say, could you tell us what you have on this subject? And is there any chance that I could see it? And, you know, if they were feeling helpful on that particular day, they might get back to you. And I hit pay dirt straight away with this, because I think it was around 2000. I wrote to them. This is, so we didn't get an official Freedom of Information Act until the 1st of January 2005. But I started writing to them in the late 1990s and around 2000. And the first thing I went for was the Rendlesham file, because I knew, although you see, before then, if you wrote to them and said, what have you got on this particular UFO incident? They'd just say, well, we've got files, but we can't share them with you because, you know, there's personal information in them from the people who've reported these things that we have to protect, Data Protection Act, and et cetera, et cetera. But they found it more and more difficult to stonewall by the time we got to around the year 2000. So I'd heard lots of people speculating about what's in this Rendlesham file and what do they know about this incident. That. And I just said, well, has anyone actually tried to ask them officially with one of these requests? No one, it seemed, had. So I just sent a formal request. And I never expected that anything would happen, but lo and behold, suddenly I had a large package arrive with 200 pages of the Rendlesham file. Here it was.
Jeez. Mm. Wow, 200 pages?
Yeah, but the thing is about that, most of it was just letters, previous letters from members of the public who'd written in asking about the incident from sort of 1983 when it first came out in the media, you know, the News of the World story that first broke it with Colonel Holt's memo. So all that's in the file is Colonel Holt's memo, the covering note from the British base commander, and then a big long series of letters from members of the public and the press. So it sounds impressive, say 180 pages or whatever, but 178 pages of that was not really of much interest. But what the desk officer did to be helpful, she actually went back to the original files that covered that period of time from 1980 and 1981. And these have since been released, and they're absolutely enormous, you know, thousands of pages. And she went through this, and she found everything that was additional in those files that related to the case, photocopied them, and put them into the file that was released to me. Now, if there's a cover-up going on, why on earth would she go to such trouble to help someone?
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Now, if I remember right, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Charles Holt have the wrong date on that memo?
Yeah.
Which caused the trouble with the radar radar reports and all that.
Yeah, this is the problem that bedeviled this case from the very beginning. That all the dates and the times in his original memo were wrong. That's the bottom line, and he's admitted this. I mean, he didn't write the memo himself; he dictated it to someone else, and this got sent off to the. And he only did this on the prompting of Donald Morland, who was the British liaison officer. He was on holiday on Christmas holidays in Scotland, I think it was. I interviewed him at the time when the incident happened, and Holt didn't actually officially notify the Ministry of Defence in London, and he waited for Donald Morland to come back, and this must have been like a couple of weeks after the incidents. Now, that in itself doesn't suggest to me that he treated it with any degree of urgency in the way that he claims he did now. So being an investigative journalist and someone that has to apply sort of critical faculties to stories that I'm dealing with every day, I just thought there was something odd about this right from the very beginning. And at the end of the day, you have to rely, if you're doing archive work and you're working as a historian, on the original documents, on the paper trail. And the paper trail is really, really clear. It does say that Colonel Holt contacted the RAF whilst he was actually in the forest looking at these lights. And there's actually a memo in the file from the radar station, the commander of the radar station, RAF Watton, saying, yes, we were contacted by Bentwaters Tower at such and such a time. We looked at our radar picture and nothing was visible. And that's a contemporary document in the file. And from the name on the document, I was able to track down this exact the person who wrote the memo, who's still alive, a guy called Derek Coombe, remembers the incident very well. And he remembers sitting in his control room looking at the radar picture, two or three calls coming through that were patched through from Bentwaters. Obviously, Colonel Holt talking to Bentwaters Tower, Bentwaters Tower patching it through to RAF Watton. And he was saying, I can see these things in the sky over Endersham Forest. Can you see anything on the radar picture? And they looked again and again and again, nothing there. Now, I know there's all these stories that have come out subsequently saying people coming forward saying they did see something on radar.
Yeah, that was just in the Phenomenon movie. Did you happen to watch that? Yeah.
I haven't seen it, no, but I'm aware that there are people who have surfaced in recent years saying that they were there and that they saw something on the radar picture. But that may well be so, but there's no documentation from 1980 that corroborates what they're saying. But there is documentation from 1980 that corroborates what Derek Coombe's saying.
I see,
to me is evidence, whereas what someone says 20, 30 years after the event, how do they know they're even talking about the same night? There are so many different UFO incidents that happened in that area. Don't forget, there wasn't one incident. You're talking about dozens of different incidents, not just around the Christmas of 1980, but on other years and other months. I mean, the number of people that have contacted me over the last 30 years saying they were involved in the Rendlesham incident, and when I've interviewed them and got to the tried to pare it down. Did you make a note in your diary? I didn't have a diary. Well, how do you know that it happened in 1980 then? I'm sorry, but that kind of evidence is not evidence. It's anecdote.
Well, I tell you, you just made a very good point, and that there's ongoing and has been. There's whatever it is going on there. It's been going on a long time.
It has.
Before and after.
Because one of the things I did during my research at the National Archives, I went through the RAF Bentwaters base log right back to the 1930s. And it was an RAF base in 1946. And I found an entry in the log from 1946, virtually almost like a rerun of the Rendlesham incident. With
1946?
1946, December. Ah. Yeah. There was a report of what they thought was an aircraft crashing into the sea off Rendlesham Forest, reported from Bentwaters Tower. Search parties went out to look for it, couldn't find anything but a big sort of light in the sky over the forest. Rendlesham Forest incident, 1946.
Isn't that something? Oh. And from what I understand, it's not just UFOs, it's other types of weird, you know, even cryptoids cryptids or whatever you call them.
Yeah, I mean, it's Britain's Area 51, Rendlesham Forest, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Have you visited the area yourself?
Yeah, many times. Yeah, I've been out at night. I've seen the fabled lighthouse that I've been told you can't see from the forest. I mean, you can't see it any longer because it's fallen into the sea now. But at the time I visited, which was, I think, 2005, and again in 2007, it was very prominent. And it's all right people saying, oh, well, you know, you wouldn't mistake a lighthouse for something that you didn't, like a UFO. But, I mean, I've heard this so many times, people saying, oh, no, people couldn't mistake something for something that is unusual. But we know from the history of ufology that 90%, 95% of reported sightings, when they're investigated and nearer the time that they've happened, turn out to be ordinary things seen sometimes. It's usually ordinary things seen in extraordinary circumstances and extraordinary things seen in ordinary circumstances.
Interesting. Well, I would have to say this about the lighthouse myself, is that they couldn't have been, like, not used to seeing the lighthouse. You know, it was something happening every time there was, every evening or whatever, right? Doesn't the light or...
Well, no, because the lighthouse is only visible from certain part, or was only visible at the time we're talking about, from certain parts of the forest. Now, Vince Thirkettle, who was a member of the Forestry Commission, he actually lived in the forest at the time, and he's the person who actually first suggested that the lighthouse was what the airmen had seen. And... Well, I've had long discussions with him. I've been out walking with him in the forest, and he said, although he was living there at the time in a house in the middle of the forest, he used to go out regularly running and jogging through the forest on these long trails. And there's been a couple of occasions where he was jogging down one of the trails and he saw a light coming towards him, and he thought, what is that? On one occasion, fell on the ground thinking it was poachers with lanterns. And it was only after... getting himself together, thinking, what have I just seen? He realized it was the beam of the lighthouse that was flashing over the trail. And if you read the original statements from the Rendlesham, the people involved in the original Rendlesham incident, they say that they responded to a report of what they thought was an aircraft crashing into the forest. We know what that was. That was a bolide meteor, because we've got the exact timing of it. At exactly the time that they reported this thing dropping into the forest. They go into the forest. They can't see anything odd when they go into the forest. Then they see a flashing light. They follow the flashing light, and then in their own words, 3 hours later, they identify it as a lighthouse.
Well, let me ask you this part.
If they saw the lighthouse all the time and they knew what it was, how did it take 3 hours walking through a forest to identify it as a lighthouse?
Yeah. Well, let me just ask you this. I've talked to Charles Hult in person, and had him on the show a number of times. To me, he seems extremely credible. And when he sees what looked like almost like an eyeball kind of, bouncing between trees in the woods and dripping some type of like magna type of thing, and then bursts into 5 lights. I mean, that's such a spectacular story. Do you think that was other than, I'm not saying I know what it is or he knew what it was, but do you think his story is wrong?
No, I don't think he's wrong at all. I think he's telling the truth about what he saw. What I'm disputing is what it was that he saw, because what I'm saying is if you can be so easily misled into thinking something is something extraordinary when it's something that's ordinary, how can you believe anything? In terms of someone's, I mean, let's think about the context in which he was seeing what he was seeing. He wasn't in a scientific laboratory, was he, with cameras and with monitoring equipment. He was in a dark forest in the middle of the night in an unfamiliar area with a bunch of excitable people surrounding him who were sort of almost like egging him on, if you listen to the tape. Here it is, sir. There it is in the distance. It's not a scientific context in which he's seeing what he's seeing, is he? So how can we know what it was? I wouldn't even try and hazard a guess at what it was, but all we know is that there was a lighthouse in the direction that he was looking, and nowhere on that tape does he say, and I challenge anyone listening to this to find me a reference on that tape to anyone saying, look, sir, there is the lighthouse. So what he saw, it may have been something unusual. It may have been something inexplicable. I don't know. But all I can say is if you there is an actual timed a recording with Vince Thirkettle standing with a BBC film crew, and you can see the lighthouse flashing in the distance. If you look at that and then you play Holt's tape, the bit where he says, there it is again, there it is again. It's exactly the same timing as the lighthouse flashing. Now, if we apply Occam's razor to this, right, you've got two options. You've got a possibility that aliens traveled zillions of miles across the universe to appear over Rendlesham Forest on the same night that Colonel Hult was there, or the possibility that Colonel Hult saw a lighthouse and thought it was something unusual. What's the most likely explanation?
Well, that's kind of two extremes, in my opinion.
I'm being devil's advocate here.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, when he is when this thing is over his head, and then they see this thing over his head, and then down toward his feet comes this beam of light shining on the ground that doesn't really look like normal light. This is how he's described it to me. There's
but, well, what would stop you there is if you look at the third paragraph in his memo, what happened later that night. Just to put this in perspective, he talks about going out further on into the forest and seeing lights in the sky that he thinks are unusual lights that are there for hours that never move. Quite clearly stars, there's no doubt about it. And yet he thought there was something unusual. I mean, a light in the sky over Suffolk that doesn't move for several hours is not a UFO. If it was a UFO, there's thousands of people who live in the town of Ipswich, only a few miles away. How come there's only Colonel Holt seeing it?
I know there's, I was just seeing if there's anyone up there that in chat that had something to come back with this. On this case, I do think has been very convoluted between the people. There's been infighting and all that, but there's just nothing that makes me feel as though it's a possibility that was a lighthouse. I mean, myself. I'm not saying it's aliens. I don't know if it's aliens or whatever it was.
I'm being deliberately provocative, I've got to say. But sure. I just think there's a lot of people who think they know about this case, but they don't really because they've never been to the location. And I think there is this thing about because it's military people involved that they can't possibly have made a mistake. Now, we know that military personnel make mistakes all the time. So why should it be any different with UFOs? I don't understand how the social standing of a person and how many stripes they've got on their arm somehow turn them into people who we can rely upon 100%. It's not what we know from real life.
Well, when you think of, you know, he was in charge of a very important he was second in command of a very
he was
a person. He's a no nonsense guy. I mean, I've talked to him for hours and hours off about houses and things like that when I was thinking about building a house and stuff. He's a no nonsense guy. He didn't want in this part of his life. It's nothing. He puts it on a shelf. He wants really nothing to do with it for long periods of time. And then, you know, he gets called out. He'll talk about it. But there's other things. What about the broken tree branches, the landing spots on the ground that are
they were both explained with down to earth reasons at the time.
Is this the rabbit theory?
No, I'm talking about the marks on the trees. They were cut. They were actually made by the foresters to mark the trees for felling. There's absolutely no doubt about that. These so-called facts are not facts. They've been adequately explained over and over again, but because people don't want to accept it, they just become part of the story. So it's not just the lighthouse then. It's like, oh, well, you know, there's the marks on the trees, there's the holes in the ground. But all of those things are only significant when you actually put them together to make a UFO case. And this is what you find in all these cases, that what sounds impressive when it's sort of hyped up and it's made into, you know, a sensational UFO incident, when you actually pare it down and you interview people and you go to the scene of the event, and this is what I found. I mean, I'd love to find evidence that something inexplicable had happened, that you know, we'd been visited by aliens. I mean, as a journalist, that would be the biggest scoop in the world. But there's no point in making things out to be something that they're not. How does that help us?
Oh, I'm not saying to perpetuate something that's false myself. I agree with that part. But I do think, you know, the old saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Absolutely. Maybe
there's something to this. What about the other people? And there was also radiation, some level of radiation.
Well, the radiation readings have been thoroughly debunked. But people just continue to ignore this, and they just ignore the inconvenience of evidence, and they just prefer. I mean, for example, Nick Pope keeps going on about the radiation readings, and because he's believed to have worked at the MOD, what he says about it has been taken as read. But the person who Nick Pope spoke to from the Radiological Protection Board at the time when Nick Pope was in the was doing the job he was doing, I said these radiation readings are not significant. But that's just been ignored. How does that help us get anywhere near the truth? All I'm saying is, let's look at all the evidence, not just at the evidence that you want to believe. And the thing about that you mentioned earlier about, you know, you believe that there's something in this, that there's something to be discovered. So do I. That's why I'm still here looking into it. And that's why I'm still making freedom of information requests about it. I don't think it's that even though I'm saying I think a lot of it is nonsense, I still think something happened that has yet to be explained. That's why I'm still interested in it.
Are you talking about this particular case or the subject in general? Yeah. So both. What about the earlier witnesses like Jim Peniston and John Burroughs, who you have coming up on your show here soon?
They saw something. They saw something. What I'm saying is there are a number of different elements to this case. Don't forget, it happened over three nights.
Right.
Why should we assume that what was seen on the first night is the same thing that was seen on the third night? Just looking at it logically, is it possible, do you think, that something inexplicable happened on the first night that caused a big sensational sort of rumor that spread through the base, and that Colonel Holt then went out two nights later on the back of that and saw something like the light out?
Pardon me. First time I ever sneezed on my own show.
Yeah, you must be allergic to Rendlesham.
I'm allergic to debunking. No, I'm not. You're not debunking. I think
trying to do is just make people think. Call me a debunker if you like, but I just think that there's
I'm not calling you a debunker because I think that's a bad word actually here.
The herd mentality that it's like, because Colonel Holt said this, we've got to believe what he says without question. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't buy that. As a journalist, I've never just believed what someone tells me. I want to find out what the truth is. And people always have motivations for saying what they say. And if we look at what Colonel Holt said, he's not even told a consistent story. Every time he tells the story, it gets bigger and bigger. You know, it's almost like a Chinese whisper or a snowball running down the hill. What he actually said back in 1980 bears no comparison to what he's saying now. So even that alone should hopefully make people who've got some critical faculties think, hold on a minute. He said this in 1980. He's now saying something completely different in 1991. Shouldn't we actually think, why has he changed his story? The thing about the beams of light going down onto the weapon storage area, he said that in 1991, but he didn't put that in his memo to the Ministry of Defense. Don't you think there's something odd about that? Of a nuclear base, and he was telling the host country that his nuclear base was in. He'd been out there and he'd saw an unknown object beaming down onto a weapon storage facility, and yet he didn't think that he should tell the Ministry of Defense about it at the time. Don't you think there's something strange about that?
And was that memo at the time a classified memo?
No.
It was not. So I'm just wondering if he could put something like that in an unclassified memo about the weapon storage area.
Well, by his own words, that's the only piece of information that he submitted to the British Ministry of Defence. I'm using his own words on this. He didn't submit anything else.
Because when I have talked to him and asked if there were nuclear warheads per se on that location, he says, don't even ask me that. You know, he can't, you know, because he's, you know, it was classified and he can't talk about it.
But I mean, consider that point. As you said, he wasn't in charge of the base. It was actually Colonel Ted Conrad who was in charge of the base, who was talking to Colonel Holt whilst he was in the forest. Now, if he's in charge of this base and, as you say, he's guarding all this sensitive material, whether it's nuclear or not, if he thinks there's a genuine threat to that base, why would he hang around in the forest all night and then go back to bed without pressing the button, getting the RAF to scramble their interceptors to actually investigate this?
I've wondered about scrambling. I've wondered about that and never asked him. So let me ask you this. We can move on to other things, but before we do, what do you think is the most compelling part of that case that keeps you interested in looking at it?
I think it's what you've just said. The story from the first night of the John Burroughs and Jim Peniston who went into the forest. You know, something happened to them.
Yeah.
They saw the lighthouse because it's in their own statements that they followed the lighthouse, but they also saw something else. Something happened to them there. And I'm open-minded. People have bizarre experiences that are remain unexplained, and having sort of spoken to John Burroughs about this in great detail, I'm convinced that something inexplicable happened to them.
What do you think about the debriefings? Do you think there was actually really drugging the soldiers, or whatever? Do you think that's exaggerated?
Who knows? But where's the evidence for it?
I guess they would never have evidence of something like that. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it sounds to me like something lifted from a plot of a James Bond film. And again, like the thing from Jim Peniston, the thing about the binary code, there was various science fiction films that were doing the rounds at the time this happened, which has got exactly the same motif in it of flying saucers crashing. Hangar 18, the movie, was on release at the time, which has got exactly the same scenario in it with hieroglyphs.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
The idea that these stories are somehow aren't related to pop culture and aren't related to science fiction and what people are watching in TV and movies, I just think you can't get away from that. It's intrinsic part of the UFO experience.
Yeah, that's a topic we have brought up a number of times. The influence of pop culture on this subject in general. I mean, just look behind you in that poster.
This is my interest in it. And to me, I'm not really interested in whether it's true or false. I think that's pointless exercise. And what someone's truth isn't necessarily someone else's truth. So it's pointless looking at whether these things are real or not. Of course they're real, because people have experiences with things let's say, for instance, that the Rendlesham UFO was something quite ordinary, but the fact that someone went into the forest and had an extraordinary experience with something ordinary, to me, it's magic. I'm interested in it as a result of that. People have been having these kinds of experiences ever since there's been human beings on the planet.
Yeah.
This is folklore. This is what's led to us, all of our myths and legends all through the ages. This is what interests me. And it's the way that people tell these stories and the effects it has on their lives. Because, Colonel Holt, whatever it was he saw, it's changed his life. He spent the rest of his life traveling around the world, being interviewed by people, having people like me giving him a hard time, and et cetera, et cetera. That has altered his life. That is interesting in its own right. Never mind what it was he saw in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. When people have these experiences, you said it changes their life. Have you ever had any experience yourself that was
unexplained? Not of this level. I think I saw. The thing that there was a Russian rocket body that disintegrated over the UK on New Year's Eve 1978 that was seen by hundreds, in fact thousands of people right across the UK, and many of whom reported it to the Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, and spectacular.
Yeah,
it was spectacular. Yeah,
and many people reported that in as a flying saucer. This is one of the files that I went through when I did the project with the National Archives. There's a big fat file of all these sightings that were made. And a lot of people in there say, when they were actually told that this was part of a Russian Cosmos rocket body, saying, like Colonel Holt, no, I, it wasn't a rocket body. It was definitely something unusual. I could see windows in it, was one of them. So what you've got to ask yourself then was, well, they said they saw it at 9 o'clock on New Year's Eve 1978, but it wasn't the rocket body that we know re-entered at exactly that moment. So aliens then came in. And they knew the rocket body was going to enter the Earth's atmosphere at that precise time. So they thought, we'll just sneak in behind it so no one will see us. If you accept that people can make that kind of fundamental error and continue to believe that what they saw wasn't the rocket body, it was a UFO, how can you believe someone like Colonel Holt when he tells you, no, it wasn't a lighthouse? That's my bottom line.
Yeah, well,
I just think human testimony is not reliable under any circumstances unless it's corroborated by other independent, whether it's radar, whether it's photography, whether it's whatever. You can't just rely on what someone tells you, even if they're surrounded by other people.
You know, I had a UFO sighting. It was nothing spectacular, but it was something that I could absolutely not explain what I saw. But, you know, I always, and that happened in 2006, not terribly long ago, but I always try to, I try to keep that fresh, because I do know another thing is that you tend to change, your memory tends to change. And that's why a lot of times these stories change, because people may pick something up on the outside and somehow it becomes part of their story.
And this
mine was just very simple though. So
this is the real shame with the Rendlesham thing, is that it was never investigated properly at the time. Hmm. I think everyone involved will accept that that's where things went wrong. You know, that if the Ministry of Defence had done a proper investigation rather than just saying, oh, well, we'll leave it to the United States Air Force, who didn't do an investigation either. So it took journalists to get this story out. And there's this other story, isn't there, that's now becoming popular. The thing from Scotland with the, you know, the big diamond shaped
object. 1990 or whatever was
it? Yeah.
We can talk about that. But before we do, I wanted to bring this up real quickly, and then we'll go into that. And that is, you mentioned Nick Pope earlier. What do you believe, there was a position in the MOD that he claims he had investigating UFOs?
Well, of course there was a UFO desk, which he was an incumbent of for 3 years, but he was just one of dozens of different people who did that task. And he didn't actually investigate anything. He just received reports and filed them. That's what he did. He was a civil servant. There was a body that investigated cases, and it was known as the Defense Intelligence Staff, DI-55, and they were the people who were tasked to investigate UFO incidents that were deemed to have some kind of military significance. And what you've got to understand, the system is extremely complicated, and there was at various times two or three different departments of the British military, on the British MOD, who were involved in investigating UFOs or responding to the public. And the department that Nick was working for was the same one as the chap I mentioned earlier, Clive Neville. He was one of Nick's predecessors. The person who was doing that role when the Calveen incident happened, the photograph that you just mentioned, was a chap called Owen Hartop. Now, again, all he did was prepare, he briefed ministers, he filed papers, but they didn't do investigations of the type that you and I would do, where you would actually go out and speak to people and interview people and follow things up. He might run a few checks with a local radar station, but that's about as far as time allowed, because it wasn't the only task that they were doing. There was something like 20% of their time was spent on this subject. So if there was anything deemed to be of potential military significance or something that needed further investigation, it was passed to DI-55 to do the investigation. Now, I've spoken to I've interviewed most of the people who worked on this subject in DI-55 at that time, and they tell me, well, Nick Pope didn't have any involvement in this. We did the investigations, you know, and we didn't share information with them because we didn't trust them.
Oh. How interesting. Is it mostly because he was actually a civil servant?
Yeah, so he was a civilian.
Yeah.
Who was pretty much doing, he was briefing ministers, he was doing PR work, and during his time in that job, he thought, well, I could make a living out of this. I could write books on it, which is what he's gone on to do. I don't understand this obsession with Nick Pope. He's an entertainer. He's not a researcher. What research has he actually done since he left that post?
Okay, no comment. I have to say, I probably should just leave that one alone.
And, you did ask me about him, so I'm giving you all.
Yeah.
I've got to say, I do think Nick Pope did a very good job in bringing the subject to public attention at the time he did. because there was a lot of people in the MOD who didn't want him to talk about this subject. And I give him praise for actually standing up and saying, you know, that this is something that needed investigated and taken seriously. But after that point, I think things went slightly wrong somewhere.
And yeah, it tends to happen. So let's go back and talk about that 1990 case. And what is a D notice, by the way?
Oh, a D notice. Yeah, this is a system that the British military have had in place since the First World War. I think that's when it came in. And it's a system whereby the military can talk to the media informally about stories that the media are thinking of running that might have national security implications. So obviously back in the First World War, anything to do with like British military movements, where ships were positioned, you know, where our tanks were, that kind of thing. And obviously they don't want the press publishing information during wartime that might be of use to the enemy. So back then they could actually say, don't publish this. Full stop, you know, so that they could issue the media with a D notice. But as we get nearer and nearer the present day, they don't tend to do that. So what we've actually got at the moment is a system that's voluntary. There are actual standing D notices that you can read on the internet. There's five of them. So the military don't tend to would not sort of contact a newspaper and slap a D notice on them and say you can't write about this subject. There is a committee that exists that you as a journalist can phone, and that there's a rear admiral or something that talks to the media. So if you are working on a story and you think, ooh, you know, this is something to do with one of our spies working in Russia or something like that, and you're a bit worried that, you know, something that you write might expose them or might be risky from a national security perspective, you can phone up the D notice committee and talk to them. I've done it myself on numerous occasions, quite recently, just to find out whether they've actually used one of these things in the context of UFOs, for instance, in the past. And so they don't actually stop you from publishing anything, but they advise you very strongly that it's not wise to publish, for example, the name and address of someone who works for the intelligence services. And I think most journalists would sort of think, well, that isn't a good thing to do, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how the D-notice system works. But as far as I've been able to ascertain, they've never used a specific D-notice to stop a story being published on UFOs. But that isn't quite the same as offering advice to an editor that maybe you shouldn't, you know, use this particular photo, or I don't know, who knows what goes on, because there's no official record of discussions that they have with editors.
How about that? Wow. And let's go back to the 1990 situation. And that was in Scotland. And what was that? And that is this one that's been explained, basically?
No. Okay. No, it's not been explained. It was a case where two people were out in the, I don't know what they were doing, whether they were walking or just passers-by. They were out in the wilds of Scotland, and they saw what they described as a very large diamond-shaped object hovering in the sky. And whilst they were watching this thing, they saw what looked like a Royal Air Force jet that was making passes, that was obviously observing this object, making passes, several passes, whilst they were watching this. And I think it was quite for a lengthy period of time. And then they took, I think, six photographs of the object, this huge diamond-shaped thing. And at the end of this observation, it just sort of zoomed upwards and vanished. And from the files that have been released on this, what happened then was the photographers sent the photographs to an RAF base called Pitrevi in the north of Scotland, and also to a newspaper, the Scottish Daily Record. And I think the Scottish Daily Record sent the photographs to the Ministry of Defence in London, who obviously thought, oh, these are interesting. And they assumed that the Scottish Daily Record would publish them. And all the bits, the files, which I have here, There's even a briefing that they produce. This is the Minister of Defence to ministers, because they obviously expected this story to break. And these photographs were apparently very impressive.
Now, this is a facsimile, isn't it?
Yeah, this is an artist's impression. I mean, anyone watching this, please don't take that as being the the actual photograph.
Yeah,
I mean, here is this what I'm holding up is all that exists in the files. It's a photocopy.
I've seen the original
photograph. Now that doesn't look as impressive, does it?
No, I mean, it does look like something. Let me pull that. I'm going to pull that up on the. No, I can't right now, but I'll try to pull that image up on the screen so people can see it in YouTube if I can get it as a image. But so this, I mean, anything can be done with a photocopy. That's kind of,
Well, the mystery is what happened to the original photographs and why didn't the Scottish Daily Record publish the story at the time? They had the exclusive. And as a journalist, I cannot understand why they haven't published, why they didn't publish the photograph at the time. And there's nothing in the files to suggest, to give us any reason as to what happened, which does strike me as extremely suspicious. And when I was running the National Archives project that led to the release of all the files, including what remains of the file on this case, I got in touch with the Daily Record and I spoke to the picture editor, the news editor at that time that I was doing this files project, which was 2009, 20 years after the case. They could not remember the incident at all. They had no knowledge of it at all. And the editor at the time, a guy called Endel Laird, he died in 2015, unfortunately. So if he was asked by not to publish the photographs by the Minister of Defence, unfortunately, he's no longer with us, so we can't speak to the editor at the time. But something strange went on. And the thing is, around 1990, the media was rife with speculation about sightings of what seemed to be a Black Project aircraft of some kind that was flying from a base called RAF Macrahanish on the northwest coast of Scotland. And there's a lot of evidence that there was a Black Project aircraft, United States Air Force or CIA project that was flying from there. I very much suspect that the thing that was photographed was some kind of secret military aircraft. And that explains the reluctance of the Minister of Defence to say anything about this case at all. They claim that they don't have any records on it. They don't have the original photographs, that they return them to the photographers. I find this difficult to believe, because in the files there is a top secret tasking to DI-55 2 years after the incident, saying, can we obtain detailed line drawings of these of the object in these images? And then the files just peter out and there's nothing more about it. Quite clearly they've been weeded, and whatever there was on file on this subject is being kept somewhere else and is being put under a different category that is you can't reach through freedom of information. And the most recent files that I managed to arrange to get copies of, DI-55 files by the guy Ron Haddo, who was the real UFO expert at the Ministry of Defence. He's the RAF scientist who produced the Condyne report. In his papers, he says that a D notice was issued on this subject in the 1990s. This is on what he calls the Astra/Aurora project. Now, the Aurora was this fabled hypersonic spy plane that we were told back in the 90s was being worked on and was flying around the globe. Never appeared, has it? Whether it exists or not, we don't know, but it could be some kind of code name for some other Black Project aircraft that's still in operation as far as we know.
Yeah. And that particular one, I would say that's most likely, you know, very, very well could be like you say, there's a lot of Black Projects and, you know, secret projects that we'll never know.
Yeah.
Exactly what
this is why I remain interested in this subject. There's a lot of nonsense and there's a lot of people seeing ordinary things, but it's almost like, you know, sort of panning for gold.
Yes,
you know, it's like you get a lot of grit in Japan. But then this is why I'm a journalist, because this is what you do. You sort of you deal with a lot of people telling you stories, a lot of which turn out to be dead ends. But then very occasionally you'll find that little nugget of gold hidden away.
Very interesting. Now, again, I'm bringing Nick Pope up only because I saw an article he wrote maybe a month or two ago where he was disappointed about the documents were not going to be released that were supposed to be released. What was that about?
Well, this is what Nick Pope does all the time, you see, because that story was based upon some research that I've been involved in that the file on the Calvin case, the one we've just been talking about, the original file has the names of the photographers in it. Right. Now, what is the best way to solve this mystery? It's to find out who the two guys were who took the photograph. Okay, so although all the British Ministry of Defence UFO files have been released, they're redacted. So all the names and addresses of the witnesses have been removed. Now, before 2005, those files were released after 30 years under the old system that we had in the UK. Bizarrely now, under the so-called Freedom of Information Act, rather than the original files with all the names and addresses of people being released after 30 years, as they were up to 2005, they are now subject to something known as data protection. So because they are people's personal details, the Ministry of Defence, in its wisdom, has decided to extend the closure period of the file from 30 years to 82 years. So we will never, not while I'm alive, not while you're alive, unfortunately, Martin, discover who these two men are.
But can that possibly be overturned, something like that?
Yes, and that's what I'm doing, because I've actually taken out a legal challenge against the MOD.
Good for you.
To get this file released, I've actually gone to the UK's Information Commissioner and put in an appeal under the Data Protection Act to have this case re-examined to get to the bottom of this. So I spoke to a journalist about this in the UK about this story, and he went off and drafted a story based upon this campaign that I was reading. And then the next thing I know, there's this story about Nick Pope that doesn't mention me.
Sorry, I brought it up.
this is almost becoming comedy in that I do all the hard work, and then suddenly the media is talking to Nick Pope, and I just think, hold on a minute, this story is something that I'm working on. Wouldn't it be polite to sort of ask me what I'm doing rather than going to Nick Pope to ask you? Now, fair enough, Nick Pope worked in that office. He's someone that journalists should speak to and get a comment from, because, you know, he's got something to say about this case. He worked in that office, and if you read his book, he said that he had a big sort of
the photo of it on the back of the phone.
And his boss came in and took it down.
Took it away. Yeah, I remember that.
Fair enough. Yeah, he's got something to say about it, but I just find the whole thing comedic.
Yeah,
you know, it's like if you read that story, you wouldn't know what had actually prompted the story in the first place. You know, the fact that the Information Commissioner was considering a legal challenge on the retention of these names. You wouldn't know that reading the story. So when this is me as a journalist talking, these things just get blown out of all proportion.
Sure.
And it's almost like once something gets into the media, you can't actually stop it, because it starts reproducing itself online and in social
media. Especially the tabloids, tabloids out there. Yeah. Especially, and I hate to say it, but the British tabloids can be pretty
far worse. Yeah. I mean, they've lost all sense of reality. I mean, and this is what troubles me about this subject, and interests me at the same time, is that you can't have a story on UFOs without having a picture of a classic flying saucer and a picture of an alien with a big head and big black eyes. So that
like
is
this right here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
someone made that for me yesterday.
No comment.
But you see what I mean? Didn't make it.
you get this is what creates ufology. And then people have experiences. And the only way they can interpret them is in the context of the legend, the myth of ufology. Yeah. And when you actually pare down the experiences themselves, I mean, if you talk to John Burroughs, for instance, he saw some kind of inexplicable life form. And this is the thing about UAPs and unidentified aerial phenomena, which is what the military prefer to call these things now.
Yeah,
you know, they're not objects; they are inexplicable things. You know, they may or may not exist. The ones that can't be explained. Who knows? They are, I don't know, some kind of natural energy or something that has always been here, that people have been seeing for ever since there's been human beings. And this is what I find the most interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, I do too. It makes total sense what you just said, because of, you think of the odds of societies from wherever they're from being exactly at the same time we are in development. It's just kind of impossible with to line up correctly. So, I mean, sure, it makes sense that if a million years ago or 50,000 years ago, if we were being visited by whoever we're being visited by now, we would have been visited by then. It just makes total sense to me. You know, the only thing wrong with today's show is we don't have enough time. Really, I felt like this hour has just flown by, and I'm hoping that you'll tell me you're a night owl and you can't sleep at night and want to do the show live sometime, because
happy to come back anytime you want, Martin. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so. I would say that although I may come across as you know, some kind of horrible debunker, a lot of the time I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm trying to provoke people. I'm trying to get them to think.
Well, I will tell you, there was a comment.
Agree with me.
There was a comment, and actually, there's one I'd like to say here too. But there was a comment earlier that said, someone said, I really like this guy because he says both sides of it. And this is something I was going to ask you real quickly. We have a couple of minutes. I'll say, what's the most compelling? This is by Luis just sent this. Do you think is the most compelling case that you know of?
Well, I can answer. I've been asked this so many times, and there's so many cases that I think are really compelling. It's just, unfortunately, the ones that I think are my favorites tend to be single witness cases. And there was one, there was an RAF test pilot that I interviewed who died, sadly, age 85, I think he was. And he had the most amazing experience in 1950. And this was in the report that I managed to uncover that was used to brief Winston Churchill. And it was his sighting at Farnborough, and he was a test pilot, and he saw this incredible object. He was on his own, unfortunately, at the time, and this came down over the airfield. It was spinning round, and it was inexplicable. It was definitely not a lighthouse. I think we can say that for sure. And and I remember meeting him. I interviewed him in 2001. He lived in North Carolina in his last few years. And he returned to London to do an interview with me at the RAF Club in Piccadilly. And I've got his story on tape. And honestly, he saw something otherworldly. There's no two ways about it. But unfortunately, he was on his own at the time. He did.
Do you have that? Is that actually an available something to listen to, or is it?
Yeah. If people who are listening want to find out more about it, his name is Stan Hubbard. He was a test pilot for the RAF. His report was featured in the report by the Ministry of Defense's Flying Saucer Working Party that was published in secretly. I mean, I managed to get a copy of this in 2001, and it was released to the media at the time. His story is in there, and they dismiss it as an optical illusion.
How about that?
What he saw. But again, it's interesting just to think that his story was read by Winston Churchill, because this report was used to brief him following the Washington DC sightings in 1952, and he said, "What's all this stuff about flying saucers?" And they produced this report that he read that's got this guy's experience in there.
Wow, I wish we had much more time to talk. But real quickly, your website for people, your blog site. And it's a great website, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a work in progress, I'll give you a bit of an exclusive here. I'm going to add a new section to the website that covers radar UFOs sometime in the new year, because I'm going to publish some new information I've got about a UFO that was tracked in space by the ballistic missile weapon system in the UK.
I always wondered about that.
So I've got a new story that I'm gonna publish exclusively sometime in the new year. So if you keep watching my website, drdavidclark.co.uk, it'll be there.
All right, say it slowly, please.
drdavidclark.co.uk.
Very good. And that's also in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, David. Really, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Okay, everyone. That's it for the show. Thank you so much for listening. Now, as far as YouTube, the next time you'll see me here on YouTube is December 1st, and that's with Robert Powell. So check that out. We'll be back. And thanks so much for listening, everyone. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.